Okay, so the red LED is on. I hope it's working. Yesterday, I have to also to switch on the microphone. Okay, now it should be fine. Yesterday, I talked about choices I had to make in preparing this lecture. Actually, today, this morning, I realized that I yet had to make another choice. In fact, I decided to only talk about the three-dimensional holographic projection of CMS and Atlas. And I'm sorry for those who expected maybe a five-dimensional version of this lecture. We stopped at the calorimetry. And let's continue now from this aspect, another important aspect of the LHC detectors. Of course, the basic goal for the calorimeter is to measure precisely as possible the energy of electrons, photons, and more generally of jets. And, as I said yesterday, give a good hermetic coverage in order to be sure that you only measure true missing transverse energy and not the fake one. And there, I put two relations already, which are already very, very basic. These are simple relations, you know, but they're really basic. Which is, for a calorimeter, the relative energy resolution goes like 1 over square root of E. This has to do because the number of particles grow proportionally to the square root of E, square root of the energy. So fluctuations are more or less proportional to the square root of the number of particles, and then the relative resolution goes like 1 over the square root of energy. So the higher you are in energy, the better actually your resolution becomes for calorimetry. On the other hand, for a spectrometer, we have seen that the relative momentum resolution goes like the momentum. So the higher the momentum, the worse the momentum resolution. It's also clear because the higher the momentum, the less charged particle is deflected, and the more difficult it becomes to measure the jitter, or deviation from a straight line. So this is very important, because now you realize that actually for very high energy objects, or for high transverse energy objects, a calorimeter is actually, at some stage, better than a spectrometer. And that's also one of the reasons why the calorimeters, for example, are very much used to trigger on the high PT objects, simply because they will give you a better measurement of the high PT. An important aspect is that you would like to have fine segmentation of your calorimeter, both longitudinally and laterally, regarding the shower, because in some cases you would like to analyze the structure of the shower in order to be able to do some particle identification or separation, or to separate between photons, electrons, and jets. Now, in general, at LHC, in view of the energies which are involved, basically we have to absorb up to TeV object. We want to be sure that we may manage to measure the energy, thus absorb electrons, photons, and jets up to a TeV or so. Now, if you look at the basic text about calorimeters and so on, you will find that, for example, the position of the maximum of a shower in a calorimeter grows like the logarithm of the energy object. And then you can also find some typical numbers like, in order to basically contain an electromagnetic shower of the order of 1 TeV, you need something like 25 radiation lengths. This is a rough order of magnitude. So if you have 25 radiation lengths, you're pretty sure that you absorb practically the whole shower of one TeV object. Similarly, to contain a hadronic jet, or the shower originating from a hadronic jet of order of 1 TeV, with 10 to 11 interaction lengths, you manage to absorb basically the whole shower. And if you absorb the whole shower, you minimize statistical fluctuations beyond the calorimeter, which then minimize exactly, again, basically the stochastic term, the coefficient appearing in front of the one of the square root of epsilon term, square root of energy term. So if you put in a few numbers, again, take lead tungstate, as is the material for crystals in CMS. They have a radiation length of 0.9 centimeter. Then if you count that you also need some space for the electronics. You have the crystal, but then you need some space to put the electronics, the readout. So you take 25 radiation lengths of this size plus some space, maybe half a meter for the electronics, then you find out what is the size roughly of the minimal size you have to foresee for putting your electromagnetic calorimeter. Then if you take a hadron calorimeter, which for example is a sampling calorimeter, and your inactive material is made of iron, for example, iron has an interaction length of 17 centimeters, you find out that in order to have 11 interaction lengths, you need almost 1.8 meters. So this size. So you have to foresee the electromagnetic calorimeter, the space, as well as the quite some size for the hadronic calorimeter. Now, if you look at CMS, this is the tracker here, and we said that it's of the order of 1.2 meter. Then come the crystals, the electronics here. So you see this additional space which is needed to read out the crystals. Then here's the coil. And the coil, we said, is of the order of 3 meter in diameter. You subtract off the tracker, you subtract off the space needed for the electromagnetic calorimeter. So you're not left with much space, a little bit more than 1 meter. So this means there's only space for something like 6 interaction lengths. Actually, the ECAL itself, of course, is also material, so it also counts as an interaction length. It gives an additional 1 interaction length for pion, roughly. So you have something like 7 interaction lengths, at least in the barrel bus. So then you know you will have pretty large sampling fluctuations of jets, which are very high in energy, beyond your hadron calorimeter. So that was one reason why, after the coil, at least in the barrel, additional 2 layers of scintillators are put. These are the so-called P catcher, or HO, outer hadron calorimeter, just in order to check or to measure these kind of fluctuations beyond the hadron calorimeter. So this is, to my mind, one of the biggest limitations, I would say, of the calorimetry in CMS, simply because of space. But when you design a calorimeter, you have to make some further fundamental choices. You have to decide if you want to have a homogeneous or a sampling calorimeter. Homogeneous calorimeter typically can give you a much better intrinsic energy resolution, but you might not have such a good sampling in the longitudinal size of the shower, and you might get less good angular resolution of your showers. There is where sampling calorimeters are better, but sampling calorimeters have a reverse intrinsic energy resolution. So in CMS, for example, the choice was for homogeneous electromagnetic calorimeter. For example, the crystals are homogeneous. It's a homogeneous calorimeter. Then you also put very forward calorimeters in the region of 3 to 5 in solar rapidity. There you have to decide a little bit where do you put them exactly. Do you have space in order to put them not too far from the direction point, and also not too far away from the, let's say, from the normal forward calorimeter, let's say from the calorimeter which goes up to the rapidity of 3. If you can put it rather close, then you can ensure that somehow your rapidity coverage moves from one part of the detector to the other one pretty smooth. But of course, if you put it close to the interaction point, you might suffer more from radiation problem. If you put it a little bit far away, that's less of a problem. But then probably your transition from one sub-detector to the other one in terms of coverage and so on is a little bit less smooth. So you have to see what is best for the detector. Then of course you design overall your calorimeter in towers, and actually towers are subdivided in basically in region of corresponding to phi and pseudo rapidity, and the pseudo rapidity they're basically pointing towards the interaction point. If you design the tower sizes in terms of pseudo rapidity, you ensure that independently of the boost, you always get basically the same number of particles in one tower. It's just again because of the longitudinal invariance and longitudinal boost. And for example, if you would decide to build a calorimeter which has tower sizes in rapidity and in phi of 0.1, and you cover up to a maximum rapidity of 5, 2 times, then you see that you needed hadron calorimeter of at least 10,000 towers. In reality, it's a little bit more because the electromagnetic calorimeter granularity is actually much finer than 0.1. And here's a plot, in fact, of the coverage in terms of interaction lengths in case of CMS as a function of pseudo rapidity. This is a central part, and you see HCAL alone, this is ECAL. A little bit more than one interaction length. This is the parallel path of H coil goes up to 7 or so, then it's the coil, and the, putting the HO brings you to a level of 10 to 11 interaction. And then come the muon chambers, and between the muon chambers you have quite a step, and this is because you have iron. But if you go to more forward directions, the situation is a little bit less problematic. There, the cover is better. And here's some picture of the hadron calorimeter when it was inserted into the coil. Here's a picture of all the crystal supermodules when they were installed inside the hadron calorimeter. Here, a picture of these crystals, more than 20 centimeters long each. In case of Atlas, the situation looks better already with the tile. Barrel calorimeter, you go up very close to 10 or even more interaction lengths, and then the forward region is also pretty good. So there, Atlas definitely has less of a problem in coverage and containment of very large energy hadronic showers. Again, for your reference, I've put the tables with most of the relevant parameters of these calorimeter systems of both detectors. We don't have to go through these numbers here, but if you want to find out some relevant number like granularity, direction length, and so on, these are the tables to look at them together. Finally, the muon system, another important system, and as I've told you yesterday in the beginning, actually, people thought that maybe after all we should completely concentrate on the muons because all the rest might just be too difficult to do. The basic requirements are you want to reconstruct the mass of a, let's say, a narrow 2 muon state, like a Z decaying to 2 muons or a Z prime decaying to 2 muons, and you would like to do it with a precision of the order of a percent or so, and you would like to reconstruct the momentum of muons in the TV range of energy with the order of 10% precision, and of course try to do it over a pretty large rapidity range. Then you know, we have seen that all this happens in a very dense environment, so you have to be sure that you can pick out these muons from the dense environment by putting, for example, an absorber, that would be the simplest thing, or by putting a large magnetic field, which basically keeps all the non-interesting low momentum stuff well inside the actual muon spectrometer. Then, in the beginning, a criterion was also that the people wanted to make sure that you can measure muons in standalone mode. Assuming that the conditions are very, very harsh, they thought, what happens if you cannot really run the tracker? Or if the conditions are so harsh that, for example, our particle ID and the track reconstruction and pattern recognition become so difficult that we cannot make much use of the tracker, we still want to measure muons. So we had to make sure that we can reconstruct the momentum of muons with a reasonable precision with the muon system alone, for at least momentum above 5 GeV. Actually, if you look at CMS, you see that for muons which have a momentum of the order of 3 GeV, they hardly reach the muon system. So only above 3 GeV or so, they manage to reach the muon system. And then they go through the whole muon system above 6 GeV. Simply again, this is given by the length of that, of course, by the magnetic field. Here in the return yoke, you have a magnetic field of 2 tesla, and in here you have 4 tesla. Now, in the case of CMS, as I pointed out yesterday, you have the additional constraint of the interaction point, which can help you. I mean, you know where the interaction takes place, and then you just take the muon system, and with the interaction point and the muon system alone, you can get a muon momentum construction with a certain precision. Atlas, on the other hand, has much less multiple scattering because you have the toroids in the air and no iron around. So this helps, as we will see immediately. And then the people decided also not to put just one muon chamber technology, but different technology because there were different requirements in terms of timing. You want to make sure that maybe different type of chambers are able to trigger, or that you have at least one type of chambers which are very fast for triggering, and other types of chambers which are good for actually the stub reconstruction. It gives you also redundancy, robustness, and so on. That's why one of the reasons why there are different technologies of muon chambers in the system. Now the difficulties are definitely in the case of Atlas, since it is so big, it's the alignment. The requirement is basically that you have to align your muon chambers up to a precision of the order of 30 micron. And this might sound, well, okay, but then if one looks at certain pictures like these here, this is some person installing chambers or whatever, and looking at the relative size, this is just scary. I'm told that this is not such a problem, but still I think this is a real challenge. This was considered to be a very, very big challenge at the beginning of the design of Atlas, that's pretty clear. Of course, one problem might be that you have a lot of bunch too. Now, for example, in the case of CMS, if you know that, you can have pretty large fluctuations of hadronic showers, of pions coming out of the hadron calorimeter going through the coil. They will give you a lot of signals in the mute chambers, and this could, for example, impact your trigger rate, because you might have a lot of fake trigger rates, too high trigger rates, you might have to raise the thresholds. This is not nice, and this is an additional issue. And one important point I mentioned is a few times multiple scattering. Again, a simple formula, the relative momentum resolution, which comes from multiple scattering, depends basically on the magnetic field. It depends on the length, basically, of the material which is traversed, where multiple scattering can take place, and something like the interaction length. So if you put in some numbers, we approximate that the particles are moving with a beta of 1, a magnetic field of 2 tesla, and a length of 2 meters. So if you take CMS here, the muons have to traverse iron over something like 2 meters. Where they can undergo multiple scattering. And this is the interaction length. Then you get the momentum resolution because of the multiple scattering is 5%, independent of the momentum. So this means you can do whatever you want. You can put the most precise chambers in the world. At some stage, you will hit this limit. You cannot be better than 5% because the muons are deflected in the iron. Now, why is this a problem? This is a problem because of the following reasons. For example, at super LHC, when the rates become very high, we will get a lot of muons, also from kaon, in case of flies and so on. Now we have to worry a little bit about our trigger rates. I mean, we cannot have infinite trigger rates. On the other hand, if you look at the muon momentum spectrum, it's very steeply falling. Now, if you have an intrinsic momentum resolution problem of the order 5%, if you have a steeply falling spectrum, basically you always move, let's say, your measurement to the higher part of the spectrum, much more than to the lower part, which means a lot of the particles which are actually low in momentum and they would not pass your trigger threshold, because of multiple scattering resolution problems, they will pass your trigger threshold. So this will saturate a lot the trigger. And you cannot get around this problem by just putting maybe more precise chambers. It doesn't help. So if the iron is there, it's there forever. And this puts somehow a fundamental limit. In the case of Atlas, this is less severe. They have air. So there are ideas, for example, at some stage maybe to put additional chambers in order to improve a little bit the momentum solution, which is possibly not limited by this fact. So this is one of the considerations here. That's what I can. These are the comparison of the layout. So in CMS, this is a view from the side. This is the barrel part of the chambers, the forward disks, and the muons are reconstructed here by the bending. On the one hand side, the muon can be reconstructed in the tracker, as well reconstructed in the muon system outside, and then actually the informations are put together. And if you combine the momentum measurement in the muon system and the tracker, you actually get a very good momentum measurement. This is a big advantage of CMS, this combination of the measurements. As I explained yesterday, there's one little issue that because of the solenoid, of course, the reconstruction of muons in very forward direction in standalone mode just from the muon chambers is by far not so precise as for Atlas. Because in Atlas, for example, the muons are deflected in this way, or they're always deflected by the field in the NCAP toroids, even if going very, very forward. So you get, for sure, a better standalone muon momentum measurement in forward direction in the Atlas muon spectrometer. Again, here are some reference numbers, and if you look at the numbers, we get the ballpark numbers as they were required by design. So if you take a momentum of 10 GV for the muons in the central part, we get momentum resolutions at the level of 1% or so. If you take out the tracker, just take the standalone system, just the muon system, then you see that the resolution degrades. And especially a big difference appears if you go to very high momentum muons, 1 TeV muon, at the forward region, eta equals 2. Combining tracker and muon system information, CMS is worse, but not so much here. At 2, the tracker still helps. But if you would just take the muon chambers in the forward direction, then you see that the CMS resolution is very much degraded with respect to others. This is just reflecting, this difference is reflecting all the things which I mentioned before. Finally, there might be some further design choices you want to impose, and this depends, I think, very much on the people designing the system. Now, one definite choice or one definite design criterion in CMS imposed by the people who really were there in the very early days designing the system was the following. They wanted really to have a modular structure of the experiment, and they wanted to impose the criterion that you can always access basically every subdetector very quickly. Now, there are some reasons also why you come to this. If you think once you have designed, once you have chosen your coil, and if you choose your coil radius of 3 meters, you know that the coil has to be pretty long, something like 30 meters, in order to have a large rapidity coverage. Now you have a pretty large coil. You put muon chambers there. You don't have muon, or you cannot put muon chambers which are 13 to 40 meters long. Try to pull the cables there, precisely. So it is clear that it has to be segmented. You have to put several muon chambers along the coil. And once you realize that, then maybe it becomes more or less natural to segment the overall detector. So segment the whole return yoke. And this then led to the design of this modular structure. So you have five rings, where the central ring of the return yoke holds the coil and all the detectors which are inside, plus the other rings, and then you have N-cup disks. So there are several advantages of this. First of all, the wheels are all independently from each other. Also in terms of, for example, of grounding and so on, which should help, hopefully, a lot in the problems of electronic noise. Then you can construct them independently. This has happened. And now that you have a modular structure, you can try to construct the whole experiment at the surface and then lower it to the cavern, especially useful if the cavern is not yet built. This was the case in CMS, and this I already explained a little bit yesterday. And the other important point was, as I said, the easy access to every subsystem. Now, if CMS is underground, these are basically the dimensions. This is when CMS is closed. And once you see CMS closed, you realize why it's called compact. You're almost disappointed when you're standing there. And it's really just a little compact piece. Everything is relative, but it's really, before you have seen it open and once you have seen Atlas, it really appears not a very big thing. But you have enough space in the cavern to open, basically to move the individual rings, and now you can access individual parts. And one very dramatic example is really the CMS pixel detector. Because in order to install a pixel detector, you have to move these rings. Here's a picture. This is the last disk, and this is the nose of the hadron calorimeter. And here's another picture. Basically, this allows to access the people, this part here inside the coil, and just basically push the pixel detector not too quickly inside the inner part of the tracking detector. And you just have to be a little bit careful that you don't destroy the wheel button. But in principle, this is an operation of a few days. In principle, you open the detector, you come there with the pixel detector, you come there, you take it out, you move it out. And this might be a big advantage in the future, we'll see. Definitely in Atlas, this is much more complicated. Much more complicated. So since the people the early people like Jim Verdi, Alain Harvey, and so on, who are really on the drawing board in the very first days, they decided this. And today, I think for the engineers, it turns out it was a good decision. Now let me come to the DAQ, the readout. And there, of course, you have quite a number of challenges too. We've seen this now quite a few times. You have a very large interaction rate, 1 gigahertz. On the other hand, you know that probably with the event sizes in place, which you can calculate by the number of channels, how much data are coming out from the whole detector, you realize it's of the order of a few megabytes. You cannot write a few megabytes at the rate of a gigahertz. So you know you have to reduce this to something like of the order of 100 hertz. So you realize you have to go from 1 gigahertz to something like 100 hertz, at which you put all the information to disks. So this is not new. I mean, it was done in other experiments that you solve this problem by putting in stages. So you put several levels of trigger, which reduce the event rate first from the 40 megahertz to something like 100 kilohertz. But this is the first level trigger. I will explain a little bit more how this works. Then you have a second or third level of triggers, which reduce from the 100 kilohertz to 100 hertz, and only keep 100 hertz out of the full rate. So in the end, you have a problem. You have to design a system which has to obtain an event rejection power at the online level of 10 to the 7. And at the online level, you better not make a mistake, because once the event is gone, it's gone forever. At the offline, you can make mistakes if you have backups of your data. At the online, you cannot make mistakes, basically. At the same time, you want that the overall system dead time is only at a few percent level. You don't lose too much. And then, of course, once you go to what's offline, you have this still, it's an enormous data rate. Still, it's a few megabytes at 100 hertz flowing out of the detector, and you have to distribute it to big farms. So you need pretty good bandwidth, you need pretty good data switches and so on. And then you need a lot of local storage for the first reconstruction, for alignment, calibration, and so on. And it was pretty clear in the beginning for the people, this is such a complicated problem, and such a huge problem, that you better not try to solve everything yourself by custom designing everything there. And this is one of the biggest, I think, one of the biggest problems of us physicists, that we always think we can everything do ourselves and better than the others. And I'm not always sure this is the case. And in this context, I think the people realize, try to use as much as possible, I mean, industrial components which you just can buy. And they made a bet. They made a bet on the Moore's law that the computer power will increase with time, and that the chip takes some time to be completed. They took a bet also on the power and the performance of network switches. At the time when these systems were designed, we did not have network switches which were able to have such a data throughput. But today we have them. So, I mean, the bet worked out. But it was a little bit of risk take. But now we can buy this stuff, and we can buy the boxes, we can buy the switches and put them in there and replace them pretty quickly. So I think it pays off now. Of course, the whole system should be very robust. It should also not change completely or just go down immediately when the LHC conditions become a little bit worse. So you should foresee certain robustness. You always try to have, basically, for example, to trigger on certain things, like on electrons, by different type of triggers, because this will help you to actually estimate the efficiency of the triggers by looking at the two different types of triggers, instead of relying on Monte Carlo simulations. Now, here's the first second, as somebody called it, as Sergio Gidolin called it, of the data taking. Now, you have the collisions, and then basically your detectors collect data. Typically, they take maybe 1 or 2 or 3 bunch crossings, depending really on the technology of the detector. So it might take 25 nanoseconds or 50, 75 nanoseconds, really, to collect, for example, the signal of a pulse in the calorimeter. So basically, after 10 to the minus 7 seconds, we have information in the most important detectors, like the immune systems or the calorimeters. So we have regional information. So we reconstruct, or we try to reconstruct some regional information, like energy in some regions of the calorimeter. Then this information is given to the next level of trigger, and the next level of, well, the level 1 trigger, sorry, has then some time to take a decision. Is this a good event or not? And basically, the time available is of the order of a few microseconds. And after a few microseconds, the decision has to be there. So now we are after a few microseconds. And then at the next higher levels of trigger, they look at more detail, either still looking just at some region of the detector, actually looking at the whole information. And then only after, and this after a few milliseconds, at this level the decisions have to be taken, and then they are written out. So let's look a little bit more at the first level, because this is, I think, interesting also. Imagine your detector, you have the various systems. Every system runs basically, more or less independently, its readout electronics, every part, subpart has to have a clock, but which is synchronized to some central clock, which is basically a LHC clock. So at some place, a signal comes in. There might be some front-end electronics which digitizes the signal. It puts it in some local storage, in some local memory, and there might be some other chip which just computes a little bit of information, just, for example, adding up the energy in 5x5 cells in a calorimeter. This is what is called trigger primitive, very basic information on, for example, energy deposits in a calorimeter. And then this information is sent to the service cavern, which is about 100 meters away. So just transporting the signals to the electronics, which is related to your level 1 trigger, takes about half a microsecond. Now, you have the information in your electronics off in the next cavern, and there you have these electronics which within something like 2 microseconds should take a decision. Taking a decision means, for example, combining information from different subparts of the calorimeter, then combining information from the calorimeter with the muon system and so on. But you have only 2 microseconds. Then the decision has to be there. The decision is there, you send it back. To send it back, same way, you need another half a microsecond. So basically, only 3 microseconds after that the event has been there and the data have gone into the memory, the decision has to arrive. Why? Because the memory is type of a pipeline. So basically, this event just makes a step at each branch crossing through the memory. And the memory is only something like 128 branch crossings long. So if there is no decision coming after 3 microseconds, this event is just falling out basically of the pipeline. It's gone. But if all the thing works and the synchronization is okay, then right when the event comes at the end of the pipeline, the decision comes, you're good or you're bad. And now you realize why synchronization is such an issue. And it's really not trivial to keep all these synchronized at 40 megahertz with these distances. So then once you know what is your budget in terms of time, what is your budget in terms of branch crossing, then you can go there and fight amongst the calorimeter and the muon guys, how much branch crossing do you get for calculating something and sending something, how much do you get? But the overall budget is fixed. And from the level 1 onwards, there's a slight difference in CMS and Atlas. So in Atlas, you have this level 1 trigger, as I just explained. Then they write out, so they take accept decisions at the rate of 100 kilohertz. Then they put the information into other readout buffers, and there's a level 2 trigger now, which is basically a small farm of CPUs. But this farm of CPUs has to take a decision rather quickly at the level, has to put the information out again at the level of 2 kilohertz. This is not enough time, even for such a farm, to look at the whole event. But that's why Atlas introduced this concept of regional regions of interest. So basically, in this farm, there are processes running which just look at a certain region of interest in the calorimeter. And the level 1 trigger says, look at this region in the calorimeter. And then the level 2 makes a little bit more precise calculation of the information, then takes a decision. Then it puts the data through a switching network and puts it in a big processor farm. Now these are of the order of several thousand CPUs. Now all the event information is put together, so all the information from the whole detector is put together, and a full analysis of the event is done, basically using more or less the same software as at the offline level. And there is some time, so here you have a time of the order of a few milliseconds, and then you write out at a rate of 100 to 200 hertz. CMS took this bet. CMS decided not to have a level 2 trigger, an explicit level 2 trigger, but basically rely on the fact that there will be strong enough switching networks so that after the level 1 you get the whole bandwidth, the whole information at this rate through this network and put everything on a big processor farm and directly basically to what both experiments call the higher level trigger. So there is this intermediate step which is different in CMS and Atlas. And you have to make some decisions also at the higher level trigger. If you look at this picture here, this is basically the detector front end. Now at the level 1, in the first part of the trigger steps, you have to do parallel processing. Otherwise, you're definitely too slow. So you look at subregions. Every subregion in parallel takes a decision or not. Then you put all this parallel information through a network into the higher level trigger. So this can be a lot of computers. And once they come out of the switching network, you can decide either you do the same thing as at the level one. You put a little bit of information into every core of your farm, and then try to get the whole picture only at the end. So this is continuing doing parallel processing. Or you decide to put the event together and then put the whole event on each PC, and one event after the other distributed on all the PCs. And so one event, one processor. This actually turns out to be much simpler for the interconnections, for the programming, and so on. So in the end, people chose this option here. Again, all this relied a lot on the availability and understanding and so on of this network switch here. And in the end comes what is your lecture, so I can skip this slide. So once the data are written to tape at 100 Hertz, then it's the offline world, and then it's the problem how you distribute the data and how you get your hands on the data again once you want to do an analysis. So now we have all the ingredients, and we finally can look at the detectors. Now these pictures you know pretty well, so I don't have to talk too much about those. I mean, those basically just include all these choices, design choices, which I've been talking about. Impressive numbers are definitely given here. Atlas has a diameter of 25 meters and a whole span in length of almost 50 meters and a weight of 70,000 tons. But there's a lot of empty space. It's a lot of air. And that's why people claim that Atlas would actually float on water. I don't think they will ever try it, but well, I hope that they won't ever try. And the other impressive numbers are, we're talking about 100 million electronic channels and 3,000 kilometers of cables. The 3,000 kilometers of cables have been a major, major headache in 2007-2008, when one had to do the interconnection work, once the thing was all there. This was a major effort. And people, for sure now in CMS, got very worried that we would not be able to do all the interconnection work in time. And a special project was set up just to speed up, get more manpower to do the work, and some poor guys had to walk around the coil and lay down all these cables and so on for quite some time. And the other important numbers, there are about 800 PhD students in Atlas. So a lot of friends and competitors. This is the most famous picture of Atlas. And maybe not all of you know that this picture appeared once even in a UK men's magazine on the central two pages. So I don't know how it ended up there, but it ended up there. Somebody showed me in an outreach meeting. This is a picture of the calorimeter inside the toroids again. And this is a picture giving a feeling of the size of the NCAP disks. These are muon channels on the NCAP disk, which are at the pretty end of the Atlas, and just pretty close to the cavern walls. This is one disadvantage of Atlas. If you go down and visit Atlas, the thing is so huge and so close to you that you have difficulties to really realize what is all standing there. In CMS, it was always easier because the thing is more compact and you could grasp better the whole thing. But that's, of course, just a completely irrelevant detail. CMS, on the other hand, is very, very heavy. This, the weight comes basically from the coil and, of course, the whole return yoke, which is made of iron, but it's not as long. It's only half as long, 20 meter and 50 meter diameter. That's why it's called compact. And subsystems we know by now. Actually, the magnetic field is not 4 Tesla. We will run at 3.8 Tesla. We could raise it at 4 Tesla, but 3.8 Tesla was considered to be a good value for safe running. And then all the subsystems, basically, I've been talking about. I don't go into much further detail here. And some of them, as I said yesterday, you know better than I do. One important number probably is that the silicon microstrip, you're talking about 200 square meters of silicon sensor. This is gigantic. This is orders of magnitude more than we ever had in any previous detector. this was also something which a few years ago we really thought, my God, how are we going to prepare all these modules and integrate them all in time? Because there were also some problems in the beginning of the production of these modules. Here's a picture. This is one of the advantages that CMS is modular. You just can move these pieces around and lower them 100 meters. We did not have to bring them up so far. Hopefully, we never have to do that. And this lowering happened at over a certain period of time, a certain number of months. Everything worked fine in the lowering. A special enterprise, a special firm was asked for doing that because these pieces weigh a few of 1,000 tons or more, and they are lowered at a speed of about 10 meters an hour. So it's definitely much lower than G. Well, the acceleration was definitely much smaller than G. And everything worked out fine. Here's an example of the tracker insertion. This is the whole tracker, and basically the whole tracker, without the pixel detector, the whole tracker was lowered as one piece in the cavern, then just inserted inside the space which was left by the electromagnetic calorimeter, and everything went fine. So everybody used the same units, unfortunately. And this is a picture, pretty short before closing the whole detector last August or so, when beam pipe, final installation of the beam pipe was done. And then CMS was closed, and CMS was ready to take the key in September 2018. You see also these shieldings, which are closed just before basically one of the last actions, because of that, just to protect from radiation. And then, if you are in the hall, you realize, in fact, as I said before, that the whole thing is really just looks like just a big piece of iron. For fun, this is a little bit giving you the relative dimensions of CMS and Atlas. So CMS is not even reaching the fifth floor for the management. Here the comparison. One important thing you should always remember, Atlas has four magnet systems if you think about it. Here you have the small solenoid, you have two forward toroids, and you have the big parallel toroids. Four magnet systems. So this is, of course, it induces quite an amount of effort. Whereas CMS has one magnet system, so things are a little bit easier there. The calorimeters are in the field region, so no magnetic field in the calorimeter region, whereas in CMS, because they are inside the magnetic field. So you have to think about, for example, about your sensors which you put in your calorimeter. The tracker has pixels, has strips, and has this transition radiation. Tracker based on straw tubes. This helps and gives you some particle identification and compliance information. This is inside the magnetic field of 2 Tesla, and this is the momentum resolution. Now let's compare it to CMS. The momentum resolution is definitely better. It's an old silicon tracker with a long lever arm. It has a higher magnetic field. So this gives you then basic, better intrinsic momentum resolution. But there's no intrinsic particle identification built in. Although people try to look at it with a DDX. It's not clear to me at the moment how much the DDX can be used. Electromagnetic calorimeter, it's mostly based on liquid argon, and this is the stochastic term in case of Atlas, 10% of the square root of E. But it has a lot of segmentation. The Atlas current has a lot of segmentation, has longitudinal segmentation, giving you pretty good angular resolution, not only energy resolution. The crystals give you a very good intrinsic energy resolution, factor of 3 better, because it's a homogeneous calorimeter, no surprise in principle. But the reconstruction, the angular reconstruction, angular resolution, is difficult to compete with this one here. And another big difference is the Hedron calorimeter. Here you have a stochastic term of 50% of a square root of E in the case of Atlas, whereas of the order of 100% of a square root of E in the case of CMS. So definitely it's clear, if you say CMS has a worse hadronic calorimeter, nobody from CMS should shoot you down, because it's just a better. And for the muons, we have seen it's basically muon spectrometer in air with a certain type of momentum resolution. And the CMS spectrometer is basically using a lot of iron, If you combine it with the tracker, you get a better momentum resolution. So it's 2% at 50 GeV for Atlas, but without the tracker. And if you combine in the tracker, in the case of CMS, you get a better momentum resolution. But you've seen before, if you don't use the tracker, then at some stage, the Atlas system becomes better. So now we have built the system. We have also to commission it, and let's maybe look at the current performance. The basic steps, how we do commissioning, were pretty clear already many years ago. So as long as we don't have beams, we have cosmics. Now here, for example, Atlas and CMS definitely have an advantage with respect, for example, to LHCb, because most of the cosmics tend to go downwards, and only a few tend horizontal to the Earth. I mean, this is just a fact. So LHCb has to rely much more on having some type of beam. This is a simulation how cosmics go through Atlas. And it turned out that what was written there in the past actually turned out to be pretty much true, and maybe even better than expected. So you can do a lot of alignment, you can check out your readout systems, you can check out for dead channels, you can do a lot of debugging. And all this has been done during this last year. Once you get some type of beam, further things can be done. Once we have one type of beam we have witnessed, namely the famous beam splash, when LHC injects a beam, basically puts a collimator in somewhere in the beam pipe, and this beam just hits the collimator. So you have a beautiful inelastic protein interaction, giving you a lot of particles moving forward, decaying pretty quickly or being absorbed. What remains is a lot of muons. And these muons, of course, have high energy, and they just move through everything, move through the detector and pretty horizontally. And this can be used then to align, for example, the NCAP parts of the detector, or in case of LHCb, they are heavily used to align a lot of the detector, just going through the system. So this is nice. And once you have circulating beam, you also have basically soft proton-proton interaction, because the beam sometimes will hit residual gas in the beam pipe. The beam pipe is not completely empty. And these soft beam gas events, they resemble a little bit very soft proton-proton interactions, kind of minimum bias. So you get a lot of soft tracks. They are curling in your tracking system, but again, they are useful to check your tracking. And of course, once you have two beams, you start to do the real thing. Here's a picture of Atlas just on June 2008 when they got ready, getting their beam pipe. And then, actually, also Atlas, of course, was ready for data taking in August 2008. And afterwards, they took these cosmic runs. So up to October 2008, they collected 500 million events, 1.2 petabyte of raw data. So this is already quite a lot. Cosmics. And in fact, it turned out, as I said before, it turned out that the alignment could be done with a precision which was basically at the precision which was expected to be only possible with the first few inverse big one of data. So we have it now already. This was, I think, a very positive surprise overall in Atlas and in CMS. And then they opened it again and closed it again in June, and again they're running, taking cosmics, and they already have more than 100 million events collected. This was the status in July, so Fabiola Giannotti presented this in July. And here's a picture of one of these cosmic muons going through Atlas here on both sides of the muon spectrometer. This is a picture of a beam splash event on Wednesday, September 10th at 9:38 in the morning. Pretty exciting morning, I remember. And this is when the effect is 450 GeV protons, about 4 billions, hit these collimators. They are 150 meters away from CMS, so you get quite a large number of muons passing through your detector. This is why the whole detector lights up. But in fact, it turned out that even these type of events are useful. And for example, with these type of events, actually the timing studies could be done pretty precisely, so the relative timings of the subparts of CMS. And it turned out that for the ECAL NCAPs, one could get the best intercalibration of the crystals of all the methods we had foreseen so far. So this also was, I think, a surprise to some of us. But, I mean, it's a good thing. I mean, it's a positive surprise. since the pictures are so nice, I have to show them. So these are just different pictures, event displays of these beam splash events in all four detectors. So now I hope I make a few of you a little bit more unhappy, less unhappy than before, since I have also analysis. Now, what in CMS, these cosmic runs are called craft cosmic runs for Tesla. This is also going on these days or the last weeks. And the CMS has collected 300 million cosmic events. I think some people made the joke that they called by now the experiment cosmic muon system, and they changed the symbol or the logo of CMS that the muons are actually coming from upwards, I think. But I hope we change it back to the original purpose. The efficiency of the data taking. This is something also very useful in these type of runs. You can test the whole system, because up to now, for maybe 5 years or 10 years, every subdetector basically has been working on its own, never together with the others. And once you start to put together everything, becomes a major effort to make the system run. And so you can train, are you able to have continuous DAQ running 24 hours a day for a week or so? And this exercise, I think these are enormously important. And now in CMS, in the first year, they managed to have a data taking efficiency of 70%. This year we are already higher. So we think we can achieve a good data taking efficiency, of course, which is important in the end, because this will determine how much useful luminosity you really have on tape. And actually, we already get a lot of publications out by the end of September. So just from this, we expect quite a number of publications. So this is another event display of the muon going through CMS. Not only CMS is publishing a lot of results, also ATLAS. So this is a slide shown by Fabiola Giannotti at TPS conference. So maybe this evening we can go through plot by plot. But somebody of you would have probably explained the details there. Other examples of CMS, how you can do the alignment. These are examples where, for example, you take tracker modules, you have a hit in the tracker modules, but then you have also other hits in other modules. You take the specific module out of your reconstruction. You reconstruct the track again without the single module, because now you know where the track should go through. You compare where the track should go through with where you have the hit in the module, and you find the residual. Then you can plot, for example, the distribution of these residuals, or actually the distribution of the mean of these residuals. And the mean is shifted if your module is in the wrong place. Then you can look at the width of the distributions of these means. And you hardly see it. The black line is before alignment, and the red line is after alignment. You see that these alignment algorithms have a big impact. This is a plot which actually I've seen on some of the posters, so some of you probably can explain much better what is happening here. You can also measure the stopping power of the crystals for muons. So you measure a muon going through a crystal, you measure how much energy was deposited. From the muon system in the tracker, you can extrapolate how long the muon actually was in the crystal, so how much material was seen. And then you, in this way, you know the delta x, and then you can do the DE over the x. So you can measure the DE over the x of a muon in a crystal. And you can compare it to simple formulas, and it turns out that it agrees pretty well. So you basically you understand your extrapolation of your tracks through the crystals from the tracking systems. You measure correctly the energy of muons deposited in the crystals and so on. This is a pretty nice test. And another thing which has been done on CMS and both ATLAS, if you have cosmic muons going through the whole detector, you can measure the momentum just taking these chambers. You can measure the momentum just taking these chambers. And then you compare the two momenta. And by comparing the two momenta, you get a measure of the momentum resolution. And if you plot this, actually what is plotted here is 1 over the momentum. And then you compare what you would expect. And you see 1 over momentum of 0.1 means these are muons of 10 GeV. And the momentum resolution, this is the relative resolution, is of the order of 1%. This is what you would expect. And many more, as you have seen. One pretty extreme example of usefulness of this cosmic data is the following. CMS has this huge solenoid, a huge volume with magnetic field, pretty homogeneous. This was measured putting in probes, NMR probes and so on. and then could be compared to a model of the field, which is basically calculated by this code, which is called Tosca. And this pretty much agreed in the solenoid. Of course, you cannot put probes inside the iron somewhere. So we relied on the model for the field out in this return yoke. And then the people looked at the data and compared basically the momentum measurement for muons when you just use the tracker or you just use the muon system. And they found a huge difference, 20% difference in the momentum. Actually, the momentum was overestimated by 20% if you just take the muons outside. And at the beginning, it was not really understood until the people realized that there might be a problem with the model of our field, which is in the reconstruction code. And it turned out, actually, that the model foresaw too much field in the return yoke. So it turned out that much more field lines are actually going out of the return yoke than we expected. There are much more field lines around in the cavern and so on. They are not going where we expected. So much more studies were done with the stray field. The stray field has also some impact in the forward region. We moved some of the detectors there. Very useful exercise. If we would have found out this only with real data taking, would have been much a bigger hassle. Now we have a new model there, and we have a pretty good understanding. So this for me is a very beautiful example of usefulness of commissioning. And in a pretty impressive table, I think on your slides actually these numbers have all fallen down, so they should be exponential. But this should be natural. These are the number of channels that are just impressive numbers. We are talking of millions of channels and how many of those channels work. And if you look at all the subsystems, at least 98% or more of the channels work. And this is not a non-trivial achievement. This you have to realize, this is a non-trivial achievement. The same thing in CMS. These are the same numbers basically in CMS, and if you look at them, also the worst case is a little bit better than 98%. So I personally am very much impressed by these numbers, and also if you look at the other numbers, I mean, you have to digest this a little bit. I mean, we have 9 million silicon microstrip channels, 70,006 crystals, we have 250 muon chambers of 170,000 wires, and so on and so on and so on. This is just mind-boggling. I mean, you hear it since 10 years, so it has become just normal. So that's why from time to time, sit down a little bit and think about these numbers, and then you say, these guys are crazy, but they managed to do it. And here's some performance comparison once more. Now let's look at photons at 100 GeV. If you look at 100 GeV, this is the plot for ATLAS, we can read off that the energy resolution is between 1 and 1.5%. In the case of CMS, at 100 GeV, it's of the order of 0.8%. For photons which are reconstructed at an efficiency of 70%. So you see there the slightly better performance of, well, the better performance of the crystals in CMS. This is just an expression of that. For electrons at 50 GeV, if you put yourself here, you can read off this of the order of 2% resolution. In the case of ATLAS, in CMS, it's 2%, but putting in also the track information. This is another example of this formula I gave you at the beginning of the lecture. The momentum resolution from the tracker degrades if you go to large momentum. The energy resolution improves. So if you combine the systems, you get an optimal system. I think a very important number actually for your analysis will be what is the systematic uncertainty with which you will be able to determine the efficiency of the reconstruction of these things. And a good guess for the systematic uncertainties will be of the order of 1 to 2%. So I think CMS atoms will be able to reconstruct electrons, for example, with an uncertainty of 1 to 2%. This is an important number. And this we can estimate already now, at least from simulation, from things like tag and flow isotopes. Here's the muon momentum resolution. I think I talked a lot about already that. I gave the numbers, so maybe we don't have to close the details. Again, muon reconstruction efficiencies should be known with systematic uncertainties, again, of this order of magnitude. It should not be 10%. It should be 1 to 2% or so. And it will not be 1 per mil, just to give the order. This is something which you should register. Now, one big difference of CMS and ATLAS is definitely the resolution for jet reconstruction. If you take jets of 1 TeV, then Atlas can reconstruct them with a resolution of about 3%, whereas in CMS it's 5%. So this is only a factor of 2. If you just take colorimetry information, the things look worse if you look at the resolution of the missing transverse energy. In case of Atlas, if you take an event where you have a total transverse energy in the event of 2 TeV, so you're sitting here, you can reconstruct the missing ET with a resolution of 25%. In case of CMS, it's 40%. If you just take the colorimeters. Now, you can improve on that. In fact, in CMS, a lot of effort has been put in improving on that. For example, by saying, well, we know much more than just the energies which are in the colorimeters. We have the tracks pointing to the colorimeters. And sometimes we may even be able, in the colorimeters, to identify a photon or electron. So instead of taking the energy measurement of a track pointing to the colorimeter from the colorimeter, which is maybe not so good, between 20 and 80, 90 GeV, take out the energy which was deposited by the track pointing to the cluster, remove that cluster from the colorimeter, and use the momentum measured by the tracker, and so on and so on. So you reconstruct really the full energy of particle flow in your event. Or similarly, just think about jets. Jets deposit energy in the colorimeter here. But of course, originally, there were some soft tracks which also belong to the jet. Now, since we have a strong magnetic field, the soft tracks are bent out from the cone. So they will never reach the area where you reconstruct your jet in the colorimeter. So you lose this energy. That's why you will measure a much lower energy in your colorimeter jet than was actually there in the beginning. But you can say, oh, good, but I have, after all, put some money in my tracker, so better use it also for this one. Find those tracks which originally were in the cone and moved out, put them back in the jet energy calculation. Don't take the energies deposited in the colorimeter for those tracks where you can find a pretty clear extrapolation, but use the momentum measured in the tracks and so on. And in this way, as is shown here, in fact, you can get much better measurement. This is the difference basically between the true energy and the measured energy of a jet as a function of its BT. And you see that for low energy jets in CMS, you only measure about half the energy of the original jet. If you just take the colorimeter information. If you put in all this other information from the tracker and so on, we can recover all of this energy, almost all of this energy. And the resolution improves a lot. This is just colorimeter. This is taking all the additional information. And similarly, if you just include the track information, which is just the same thing. And in the missing ET resolution, the same thing. If you include all the other information, your resolution will improve a lot. And with this, in CMS, I think we can recover quite a large part of our disadvantage from the colorimeters. And in the end, I think these are the best prepared detectors probably which have ever been there at the collider. Because there has been so much quality control, there has been so much commission, there has been, unfortunately, enough time to do a lot of testing before the machine starts. You can skip that. So, this is the summary of what one action meant. I have to stop. I need a start because I didn't look at it. Okay. So, this is the summary of part one, and I think this is a nice law, which one can always remember. Oh, that was law. I found it somewhere. And it definitely applies to the CMS, to the LHC detectors and the machine, I think. So in summary, the detectors hopefully are optimally designed to exploit the physics which will eventually come out of the machine. But one has to realize that something like 20 years of R&D and construction and so on have gone into it. And by now, thanks to these cosmic stator runs and so on, we have a pretty good understanding of detectors, how they should operate in real life. So now we are pretty close to the end of the tunnel. So this is... Well, I always say that if you see the light at the end of the tunnel, it could also be a train coming towards you. So probably I better stop here then, and tomorrow we go to part two, and then we see how much I can cover there. So thank you.
So we have an extra 10 minutes to get to the end of this part, but there is time for some...
Well, what you can do is if you look at all subsystems, for example, then if you look at your electromagnetic calorimeter, for example, you might find very localized clusters with absolutely no track pointing to it. So this has been either a photon or by zero. And you just take the energy which is really measured in the calorimeter, because this is well measured. And actually, you look also in the calorimeter, hadron calorimeter behind it, and you check also that there's nothing behind it. If there's something behind it, then probably it has not been a pi zero. Then it might have been a pion, and maybe the extrapolation is not okay, and there has been an abnormally large deposition in E-cal, is what you expect for pion and so on. So you go really step by step, you look at the whole system, and you try to disentangle as much as you can. How much in terms of memory you can put there at the front end to store continuing storing events. Probably that's an issue. I'm not such an expert on the level one, all the detailed aspects, so I don't know. I cannot be sure now that there are not other arguments behind that, but this is the first guess, that you cannot put arbitrary much memory over there. Well, you start with saying, but what again, you think about what is the physics. So we have seen the most interesting physics is high Big T physics. So you look for jets above a certain transverse momentum. You look for muons above a certain transverse momentum, electrons, for example. This is the first thing you can do. And then you have calorimeters and muon systems which are fast enough to take locally a fast decision. Now, you look a little bit more what is your physics, and then at the higher level trigger, where you have a little bit more time, you can now try to adapt to different type of physics, like top physics, you know what you might be looking for, or then you say, I want to have two muons opposite sign plus jet plus missing a T, also missing a T is important information, and so on. So you start to put together more information in order to be sure that you cover the basic physics. Now, of course, the obvious question is always, how are we sure that there's not something completely new which is absolutely not taken account of in our trigger path, you know, or the list of the trigger. And fundamentally it's a problem that's difficult to resolve. One way to resolve it is you just take random triggers at a certain rate, for example. At some stage you just open it and check that at least the things look more or less as they should look. But I guess there will always remain a certain uncertainty that something escapes you because it produces such a weird final state which is just not foreseen by any trigger. I think it's difficult to have 100% coverage. But things like random triggers at least allow you to control that what is coming in then is also classified afterwards as it should be classified and so on.
Does CMS also use regions of interest, like
atoms,
at level one?
Yeah, actually, CMS does not use exactly the same concept. It's a little bit more washed out. So CMS does not have a dedicated level two. It only has the HLT farm. But within the HLT, the algorithms run, okay, within the farm. And these algorithms typically are structured in steps. So the algorithm first looks at a certain aspect, and if this is okay, then the algorithm continues. It's like your analysis, okay? You put a set of cuts in a certain sequence. And you could now view this sequence of analysis at the HLT as a level 2, a level 2.5. For example, for electron reconstruction, we have a level 2.5, where we look if there's a pixel hit for an electron, for a calorimeter cluster, and so on. So there's a subdivision at the HLT level. And I guess that at the HLT, definitely the algorithm typically will start at, in regions, of course, will start looking at objects which have been indicated by the level one, of course.
So there is some sort of predefined information.
Yeah, but the difference is that in CMS, after the level one, into the HLT, the whole event is built. So at the HLT level, I have the whole event. Whereas in Atlas, into the level two, only the region of interest is put and taken for the calculation. And only afterwards, the whole event is built. So in principle, I have at the HLT in CMS, I have the whole event information, but still I will start my algorithm in steps. Okay, I will perform a certain sequence to speed up again. Because if I find at the very early stage of my algorithm that there is a problem that it's just below certain cuts, then there's no need to look at the rest of the event, even if it's there. I don't know if I'm clear.
Yeah.